Okay, this is Hosea chapter 3. Chapter 3 is kind of short. We started with Hosea chapters 1 and 2 last week. Discussions of the "Thou art not my people" prophecy. So let's continue from there.
Hosea chapter 3. Then said Yahweh unto me, "Go yet, love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of Yahweh toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagons of wine. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver, and for a homer of barley, and a half homer of barley. And I said unto her, Thou shalt abide for me many days, thou shalt not play the harlot, and thou shalt not be for another man, so will I also be for thee. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king, and without a prince, and without a sacrifice, and without an image, and without an ephod, and without teraphim. Afterward shall the children of Israel return, and seek Yahweh their God, and David their king, and shall fear Yahweh and his goodness in the latter days." End of Hosea chapter 3.
There must be some correlation between the children of, between the whore not having her lovers, and the children of Israel being without the symbols of her lover, without the symbols of Yahweh that made them a nation, and the sacrifice, and that image isn't an image, it's also a pillar. And I believe that that refers to the pillar of witness here. And the ephod was the garment of the priests, and the teraphim. All these things were also symbols of the children of Israel, that the national symbols, right? We have the ephod and the teraphim mentioned in earlier scriptures in the book of Judges. Well, these, I believe, here represent the national symbols of the children of Israel, that they would be without those things during the time of their captivity. And that's also why, under the divorce decree and in the Christian era, all those national symbols that the children of Israel were commanded to do in the Old Testament are no longer valid. I believe that this prophecy stands for all of the national symbols, even though these things are just used as an example. That's my opinion.
Yeah, like even though they built Zerubbabel's temple, they didn't have the mercy seat. So like, how legitimate were those sacrifices?
Right. Without a mercy seat, there's no atonement for, under the law, there's no atonement for sin. Because Christ is the only atonement for sin. They couldn't make the proper atonement because they couldn't sprinkle the blood on a mercy seat, the blood of the sacrifice victim, as they commanded in the law. That sin offering for all the people that was done once a year couldn't be done. A lot of, but I don't think any denominational Christians realize that without that Ark of the Covenant, there's no atonement for sin, period, according to the law. So the Second Temple period, there was never an atonement for sin, just like the children of Israel in captivity had no atonement for sin. They were going through the motions and thinking they were doing well, but they really couldn't keep the law because there was no Ark of the Covenant.
I think Yahweh sort of hints towards that in Haggai, because he tells Haggai to remind the people they're still unclean to him.
Yeah.
So I think Yahweh makes it pretty evident in some parts of the prophets that the Second Temple wasn't so that the people of Judah and Benjamin would have any reconciliation to Yahweh through those sacrifices, but to pave a way for the Messiah.
Right.
Precisely. So I don't know why the Judeos would miss that, but I guess they're stupid.
Yeah, Well, the Jews said so. The Jews said it was all right.
Yeah.
That's all they need.
And the Jews aren't smart either. So if you're going to follow a Jew, you're going to have a lot of dumb theology.
Well, maybe that's where the chicken twirling came in.
Yeah. They just decided that, Bill, randomly. They just decided one day, oh, we can't make sacrifices. What do? And some dumb rabbi said, oh, what about a chicken twirl? That should be good enough.
I can't find a better narrative for it. I gather we could proceed with chapter 4, but just note that this is the second whore that Hosea was told to go get himself.
Yeah, they're different. They're not the same one. Some people confuse that, apparently. I've read.
It's probably a good thing they may not have had STDs in the white world at that time. I don't know that they didn't, but they may not have.
Does he get a third later on?
I don't think so.
Then maybe the two represent the sisters, right? Like Ephraim and Judah.
Yes, that's very possible.
Okay, chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. Hear the word of Yahweh, you children of Israel. For Yahweh has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood touches blood. Therefore shall the land mourn, and everyone that dwells therein shall languish, with the beasts of the field and with the fowls of heaven, yea, the fishes of the sea also shall be taken away. Yet let no man strive, nor reprove another, for thy people are as they that strive with the priest. Therefore shall thou fall in the day, and the prophet also shall fall with thee in the night, and I will destroy thy mother. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me. Seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy God, I will also forget thy children. As they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame. They eat up the sin of my people, and they set their heart on their iniquity. And there shall be like people, like priest, and I will punish them for their ways, and reward them their doings. For they shall eat and not have enough. They shall commit whoredom and shall not increase, because they have left off to take heed to Yahweh. Whoredom and wine and new wine take away the heart. My people ask counsel at their stocks, and their staff declares unto them. Actually, do you think I should stop here? Continue.
That's fine.
Okay.
We'll pick up
verse 12.
We'll pick up with verse 12. That this blood toucheth blood. The word for blood is plural in both instances. Bloods touch blood. Bloods. And even though bloods is usually, when the word blood is plural in the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, it is usually an idiom for bloodshed, right? I will cleanse your bloods. That's your bloodshed. And there it's clear in the context where it says that, but here it's clear that the context is committing adultery. The context is committing adultery, and bloods touch blood. So in the Septuagint, and adultery abounds in the land, and they mingle blood with blood in the Septuagint. And that's the way Brenton translated it, even though in the Greek, blood is plural in both instances, just like it is in the Hebrew. But I believe that Brenton captured the correct essence, and the Greeks captured the correct essence that mingle is actually a word, megusin. It's a third person plural of mix, of a word megnumi, to mix. So they mix bloods with bloods in Hosea chapter 4, 2 in the Septuagint. The word adultery also appears earlier in the passage in the Septuagint. So adultery is poured out upon the land. And for that, Breton said, an adultery abounds in the land, which is kind of fine because that's sort of an allegorical use of the word to pour. And they mingle bloods with bloods. In the Greek, it is Septuagint, and that word mingle means, it literally means to mix. So that's how they interpreted Hosea chapter 4, verse 2. And I would interpret it the same way. I really would. But in the NAS, that phrase, they break out, and I would like to study that even more. The Septuagint speaks about lying and murder and thefts, and adultery is poured out upon the land, and they mingle bloods with bloods. That could mean that they add bloodshed to bloodshed, but where it says the context of that is an adultery is poured out in the land, so they're lying, murdering, stealing, and race mixing, as far as I'm concerned, committing adultery with these other races, these other nations.
And also at verse 10, it says, they shall commit boredom and shall not increase. Well, that's a lot like today where people are race mixing. When you race mix and your children are little, well, your offspring are little bastards, then the people aren't increasing. Instead, they're producing these bastards that just devour the land and we shrink away. And the bastards and the mongrels increase and increase. And also we know that from today that when all the women become whores, they don't have children. They don't commit to a husband and have children. They just commit whoredom the whole time and they don't have kids. And that's why our birth rates today have just gone off a cliff.
Michael.
Noise.
Michael. Wow, Michael. This is recorded. Okay. Sorry. Michael's trying to destroy our recording. Yeah, you're right. Michael, if you want to talk, that's fine, but you can't leave your mic open. Joe, I agree that the passage in verse 10 strengthens our interpretation of verse 2. But whether it's adultery or murder, it's still bloodshed.
Right, yeah, because like race mixing is murdering your own people.
Yes, when your son or daughter race mix, not only are you basically murdering her seed, you're killing her seed, but with her race mixing, you're allowing her to kill her seed, or you're the father, you're actually killing her seed. But you're also depriving some young man or young woman of a viable spouse.
Yeah, it isn't just the women. I know I said women before, but you know the men are very much involved in that. They're not faithful to the women. So no one ever actually ends up having children because they just go from spouse to spouse, whoring around. They never get to the point where they start a family. And at the same time, the men are like marrying in quotations, you know, fornicating with Asians and other beasts. And that's not a viable offspring. That's just abomination, corruption. You're corrupting the land.
Well, you're basically murdering your own seed because you don't have a seed that's acceptable.
Like, imagine how many generations came before you, and then they get to you, and you just, yeah, you just destroy your whole family line. You're murdering your whole line.
Well, no community has a perfectly even amount of young marriageable boys and or men and young marriageable women. It's, but when you let your kids mix with the other races, then you're depriving white boys and girls in your community of viable spouses. So you're basically killing off the entire community, not just their own seed, but the whole community is suffering for that.
Yep. And it's not just in big cities. It's in small communities as well. You see it everywhere.
Nowadays. Yeah, I mean, we do. We've seen it all over the country in every small nook and cranny. It's incredible. I mean, I like little Susie in fourth grade, but now she's going out with Tyrone, so I ain't going to mess with her no more. Yeah, the hell with that.
Yeah, 20 or 25 years ago, it was like just in the big cities, and the small communities were sheltered from that. But today, even you're just small towns of 3,000-4,000 people, or even in some cases, small communities of 500 people, like you have around here. And there will like always be, there's some Mexican out there or a nigger, you know, you got your little nigger family, you know, or crossbreed family here, and you have one there, and they're in school with your children and everything. And it's just a matter of time before they try to corrupt your kids.
Well, we see far too much of it here. This is vacation land down Panama City Beach, and it's like every other blonde girl or every other white girl has to have a dindu accoutrement. It's crazy. It's like dindus or accessories or something.
And we have no authority to change things. Like if we tried to, you know, set things right, we'd be arrested or something, you know, for even saying it's wrong.
Right.
But it's like we live in their culture, and their culture is just, you know, they don't get married the way that white people do. So what has happened is the culture has been changed to the non-white culture where they just breed like rats.
Yeah, it's the hookup culture.
And so it doesn't cause them any issues because that's their natural culture. They just breed like rats, like normal. But white people are more sophisticated. And they need more, they have a more complex society. So they have this whole courtship and marriage ritual, which leads to families. And when that breaks down, you know, our society breaks down, but the niggers and the Jews, that it doesn't affect them. They're fine because that's how they do things anyways. They just breed like rats. So it has an impact on us, but it doesn't have an impact on the non-white races, in my opinion.
Yeah. And yeah, I can't figure out where the appeal is for a white man or a white woman to be screwing around with somebody outside their race.
Yeah.
And the only
low IQ, ugly.
The only reason that white women, well, not the only reason, but it's kind of like the feminist movement. They've shot themselves in the ass over the transgender stuff. They've advocated for that so long, and now it's turning around and biting women in the ass. The same thing happened with the interracial stuff. Like, they had to teach the niggers and Mexicans Christianity to where they could control them, to where they could make them somewhat civilized and be able to somewhat adapt to a society. And by teaching them Christianity, they were able to kind of guilt them into acting somewhat like humans. And now it's completely bit them in the ass. And now your clergy is telling everybody that it's okay. God loves everybody. And everybody was made by God. And a white woman can marry a nigger, or a white man can marry a nigger. And it's just bit us in the ass.
OJ.
OJ
dressed him up. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. OJ laid the path on how to fix all that.
Yeah. Yeah, she was an early toll payer.
Yeah, you kill them.
They kill them all the time. There ain't too many old mud sharks, unless they start old.
You can't hardly open up the news from day to day, open up the national news and read it that you don't see a story of a nigger raping and killing a white woman.
No, you can't. Okay, Noble, we can proceed with Hosea chapter 4, perhaps.
Yeah. Right. Verse 12. My people ask counsel at their stocks, and their staff declares unto them. For the spirit of whoredoms has caused them to err, and they have gone a whoring from under their God. They sacrifice upon the tops of the mountains, and burn incense upon the hills, under oaks and poplars and elms, because the shadow thereof is good. Therefore your daughters shall commit whoredom, and your spouses shall commit adultery. I will not punish your daughters when they commit whoredom, nor your spouses when they commit adultery. For themselves are separated with whores, and they sacrifice with harlots. Therefore the people that does not understand shall fall. Though thou, Israel, play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend. And come not ye unto Gilgal, neither go ye up to Bethaven, nor swear, Yahweh lives. For Israel slides back as a backsliding heifer. Now Yahweh will feed them as a lamb in a large place. Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Their drink is sour. They have committed whoredom continually. Her rulers with shame do love. Give ye. The wind has bound her up in her wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. End of Hosea chapter 4.
Yeah, you know, these churches love to dismiss this as spiritual fornication and spiritual whoredom, but the men have committed whoredom by worshiping the foreign idols. So the women and the daughters are going to commit actual whoredom, because all of that Baal worship is all about sexual fertility rites. They were sexual fertility cults. They were actually committing literal whoredom and literal fornication, literal adultery. And that's the allegory. The men are committing spiritual adultery, and the wives and the daughters are going to commit literal adultery because the men have led them off into this paganism, this Baal worship. It's natural to Baal worship. And that's
where,
well, I spoke about that in Broken Cisterns. I made lengthy citations on the fornication and adultery being committed in the ancient pagan temples from Herodotus, as old as Herodotus in the 5th century BC, as well as Tertullian in the 3rd century AD.
Is that what you think it means where it says they sacrifice with harlots? Because in the Baal temples, there were priestesses that were whores, Bill.
Hmm. Yeah, they were all whores. I mean, the pagans were all whores. They were all harlots, the men, the women, that they arranged. That's the original marriage at an altar, was having those sexual fertility rites in the Baal temples. Israelites didn't get married at the altar. They got married at home in their tents.
Hey, Noble, would you read that verse the backsliding heifer again?
Sure. For Israel slides back as a backsliding heifer. Now Yahweh will feed them as a lamb in a large place.
Said heifer.
Or whatever. I guess I'm mispronouncing it.
Do Canadians say heifer, maybe? Because I say heifer.
No, it's I wasn't going off about that. No, but it's just interesting the context that's put in. So a heifer, to put it into context, if the word in the Hebrew actually translates to what the word in English means. A heifer is a female cow.
Yeah, this is a cow.
that has never have a that's never had a calf. So whenever we have, when you have bovines, cattle, if it's a heifer, it's a virgin cow that's never had a calf. And once she's had a calf, you call her a cow.
Well, this is the allegory here, right? That word backsliding means rebellious, and that's probably how it should have been translated. A rebellious heifer is one that doesn't want to be mounted by a steer, I thought, or by a bull, I think. That's the way I'm looking at this.
Yeah, right. She's but where would that? Okay, so if you put that in context of people, which is referring to people, so a virgin that doesn't want to get. The virgin that doesn't want to have sex? Is that what it's?
The virgin that wants to run off and not have intercourse with her God?
So the virgin that run off and have intercourse with a profane God or someone that's not.
Well, I mean, okay, let me be a little prurient here. It's okay. There's no doubt the virgin's going to get taken. So, right, if the virgin doesn't want the bull that's arranged for, which is Yahweh in this case, then yeah, she's going to end up committing playing the harlot and committing adultery, even if that wasn't the plan. So yeah, that's how I'm reading this. That's the allegory I think is being made.
That's where I'd go with it, because okay. Heifer should be, it should be, you know, the Israelites were a cultural society, and a heifer would be considered virgin female line.
Every young virgin is going to end up in bed with somebody. It's inevitable. So you may as well end up in bed with your God, and end up in bed with the bull that you were betrothed to. And Israel wouldn't do that. Israel's rebellious. So they ended up committing whoredom.
Right.
I think another thing we can glean here is a transition, because Yahweh seems to refer to Israel as a cow because Jeroboam set up the calf worship. So it's sort of representing a transition from their paganism to Christianity, because it says now Yahweh will feed them as a lamb in a large place, and that large place is the place of their captivity and dispersion in Europe and Asia.
And that's acceptable. That's fine. That's good.
And I think also since that dispersion was the breaking forth of children in a way, because they multiplied in their divorce, I think maybe the heifer part can be referring to as well, that in this small place of Palestine, they're not multiplying near as much as they're going to in Europe, right?
Right, and that's the theme of a few other prophecies as well.
Yeah, she who has the husband shall have less of the kids of she who has the husband, a verse like that.
Right.
She, yeah.
That's in Isaiah.
Yeah, I thought it was in Isaiah. And you know, in verse 17 it says Ephraim is joined to idols, let him alone. Well, normally when you're joined to someone, that's like the marriage thing, isn't it? So the previous verse is about the heifer, and then 17 is Ephraim is joined to idols. So that's like, you know, the two have become one flesh. She's married an idol. The nation has married an idol. So what you were saying about the heifer, the virgin heifer, or in verse 17, we have Ephraim is now joined to idols.
Right.
Well, I just wanted to put that out in case there was somebody listening that doesn't understand the agricultural side of it, to know that a heifer is a virgin cow, a virgin female, bovine.
And doesn't get mounted by a steer. I'm sorry.
Any particular reason why they would pick Ephraim?
Because the capital of ancient Israel was in Samaria, which is the city of Ephraim, and Ephraim is the oldest son, who represents Joseph's double portion. So he the oldest son of the favored wife, who represents Joseph's double portion. So Ephraim came to represent all of Israel in Hosea. Not Judah, though. Only the 10 northern tribes. Okay? Throughout the rest of Hosea, Ephraim represents all of Israel.
So then maybe like Joe was saying earlier, then 3 was for Judah and this is for Israel?
This prophecy is for Israel. It doesn't have anything to do with Judah.
Yeah, but he was saying that that 3 would have been for Judah and maybe that this would be for the other 10 tribes.
Well, the Ephraim prophecies are all for the 10 tribes, Martin. The 2 whores representing Judah and Israel is that allegory would still hold up. Yeah. We're past that whore now, right? We're speaking about the people who are about to be taken into Assyrian captivity. We're speaking about Ephraim here.
Okay.
And the fact that Ephraim represents or stands for all of Israel here is supported in Ezekiel chapter 37 in verses 19 and 20, where it says, "Say unto them, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his fellows, and will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick," right? So that supports the allegories in Hosea, where Ephraim stands for the 10 tribes. But of course, Ezekiel wrote about 150 years after Hosea.
Bill, that's the 2-stick prophecy, right?
Yes. Well, I call it a 1-stick prophecy because that's how they're going to end up. But yes, it begins with 2 sticks. Yes, sir. Ezekiel chapter 37.
Well, I don't view it as a man last or a mass of land. I view it as a body of people because the maggots in 1948 named it Israel and then jumped in there to claim the inheritance.
Well, right. I mean, I didn't say anything about land. Israel is the people, no doubt. The land doesn't matter.
Correct. Yeah.
The last verse here, 19, reminds me a bit of Revelation, because if I remember correctly, the woman, she's given wings before she's sent to have grace in the wilderness. And I think there's something similar to that in Zechariah as well. So I wonder if verse 19 is referring again to the future dispersion of Israel and the fact that there, after their divorce, they'll be ashamed, especially when they receive Christianity and realize just what they did.
That's a pretty good observation. That's a good observation. I never cross-referenced it, but that is a good observation. Maybe I should. Meaning that she's being taken away.
Yeah. I'm also wondering if the reference to sour drink in the verse before it has any connotation with mixing in its original language.
Well, I mean, their drink is sour, and that's the same as the grapes of Sodom, sour grapes, the sour grapes that that Jeremiah prophecies the children of Israel will be made to drink when the land or would voluntarily drink, I should say. It's those who drink the sour grapes who are going to be punished when the land's sown with the seed of man and the seed of beast.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be another valid cross-reference. I mean, it's minor, but they're both valid. and this is also speaking of the dispersions or the coming captivity, as Hosea begins to write, as we discussed last week, as Hosea begins to write, the first Assyrian deportations are in the time of Uzziah, who's Azariah, and about 743 BC, towards the end of his rule, are the first incursions of Assyria into Israel proper, in the Transjordan area and in Galilee, where, when they begin to take large amounts of captives into captivity. But it's not all recorded in scripture. There are allusions to it and references to it, but they're not detailed.
I just noticed verse 8, which says, "They eat up the sin of my people." And I think that's referring to the priest, because every time the people sin, the priest sort of benefit from that. And you think about today, where a lot of churches want their congregations to be as big as possible, so they invite everyone they can into their church and they sort of feed on the sin of the people.
How do you think people are going to feel in the resurrection when they find out that every dime they ever gave to the Roman Catholic Church or any of these Protestant churches was just wasted? They were throwing it at nothing. And I'm not saying every Protestant church does bad, but I'd say that the great majority of money given even to Protestant churches is wasted.
It's going to be a lot of shocked faces on that day.
When has the Roman Catholic Church, when's the last time the Roman Catholic Church ever did anything good for the its own benefactors, for the white people of Europe? Ninth century, 10th century, 12th century. I don't know. The Roman Catholic priests in France didn't even want to turn over their gold to Charles Martel. They hated him for taking their gold to pay his troops to defend them against Muslims. They hated him for that. They'd have rather had their gold. And Muslims.
Yeah, I think they're going to be shocked too from the fact that they're not getting any points for chanting rosary or doing a ritual, or if you're Protestant, for going to church every Sunday, just as Yahweh says over and over in the prophets, and just as Christ condemned the Pharisees for. But I think they're just going to be shocked.
Well, Charles Martel saved the rest of the France and the rest of Europe from Islam. But what the church doesn't say is more telling than what it says, because he was never beatified for it. He was never awarded any church glory for it. Never.
Nope. We just have a patron saint of bastards instead.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And they invite the Arabs into the Catholic churches to, you know, do their ceremonies in the Catholic Church, and they cover up the cross and invite them in.
Yep, they do. And today they're having drag shows in churches, so what the hell?
And baptizing niggers.
Yeah. Yeah, they've been baptizing niggers a long time, but yeah, that's a terrible thing to do also.
Under five.
Hosea chapter 5. Hear you this, O priests, and hearken, ye house of Israel, and give ye ear, O house of the king, for judgment is toward you, because ye have been a snare on Mizpah, and a net spread upon Tabor. and the revolters are profound to make slaughter, though I have been a rebuker of them all. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hid from me. For now, O Ephraim, thou committest whoredom, and Israel is defiled. They will not frame their doings to turn unto their God, for the spirit of whoredoms is in the midst of them, and they have not known Yahweh. And the pride of Israel does testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them. They shall go with their flocks and with their herds to seek Yahweh, but they shall not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them. They have dealt treacherously against Yahweh, for they have begotten strange children. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. Blow ye the cornet in Gibeah, and the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Bethaven, after thee, O Benjamin. Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. The princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound. Therefore I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment, because he willingly walked after the commandment. Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness. When Ephraim saw his sickness, and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the king Jareb, yet could he not heal you, nor cure you of your wound. For I will be unto Ephraim as a lion, and as a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear and go away. I will take away, and none shall rescue him. I will go and return to my place until they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me early. End of chapter 5.
There are claims that all the Levites fled Israel and they all went over to Judah, and that's simply not true, and this verse here proves it wrong. It proves those claims wrong. And I've actually heard Jews and denominational Christians say those things, as well as CI people, Identity Christians, that all the Levites went to Judah when Jeroboam changed religion, and it's not true. A lot of them probably went along with Jeroboam's pagan religion. There's no doubt some of them went to Judah. It says so in Scripture. But here, that they're priests of the house of Israel are being addressed here. So a lot of Levites must have stayed behind in Israel. A number significant enough to be addressed here.
And just because the chapter changes doesn't mean, actually you're saying now it's addressing the priests, but I would still, like at verse 7, it says, they have dealt treacherously against Yahweh, for they have begotten strange children. Well, you can connect that back to the previous chapter, can't you?
Absolutely. These chapter breaks are artificial. The context never changes. Even though it's addressing the priests, it's still addressing the house of Israel and the house of the king of Israel, not the king of Judah, the king in Samaria. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hid from me. So the entire context is still the whole house of Israel.
And it's whoredoms, and it's whoredoms are begetting strange children.
The begotten strange children is obviously the result of the whoredoms that were explained in chapter 4, that were described in chapter 4, I should say.
And if we want to be critical of ourselves, like, what could a strange child be other than a mongrel? Like, think about, like, could it be, oh, I don't know my own children somehow? You're like, what could that mean other than a mongrel?
Yeah, exactly.
In this context, it can't be anything but a mongrel. A Zur child, a Zur can be used of another Israelite that you don't recognize, right? But if it's used of a baby that you beget, you don't recognize it because it doesn't look like you. You don't recognize it because it's not of your own race or tribe. That's the only thing it could explain what's being said here, is that it's a bastard. It's the result of that fornication that was described in chapter 4.
I know many times children of adultery were still sort of accepted. Like Solomon would have been a child of adultery, wouldn't he? And he wasn't a strange child who was outside the congregation.
Right.
Yep.
The well, men didn't have the restrictions that women did, but Jephthah was the son of a whore. He was the son of a harlot. He was chosen to deliver Israel from their adversaries in his time. And Jephthah had brothers that were legitimate from a legitimate wife.
What do you mean, Bill, when you say men don't have the same restrictions as women? Is that because a man can have multiple wives, whereas a woman has to have one?
Yeah, the law permitted a man to have multiple wives. So if Jacob had four wives, and even though two of them were concubines, none of his sons were considered bastards. They were all considered legitimate, all 12 of them. All 12 of them received a share of the inheritance. They were all considered legitimate. So typically, like the sons of Hagar, Ishmael wasn't receiving any inheritance. He didn't receive an inheritance. He was just put out. And that was because Hagar was a concubine. And in the ancient world, concubines didn't have any, their sons, their children didn't have any entitlement to an inheritance. Keturah's sons later on in Abraham's life were also put out without any real inheritance. Abraham just sent them east. Go ahead, beat it, scram. Off you go.
These days they're called single mothers and the government takes care of them.
Right. So we all have to take care of them because the baby's daddy is off in prison for 10 years for crack and armed robbery.
I was going to ask, I don't know how Judeo-Christians even see the word strange child and can turn it into anything other than, like we said, a bastard. I don't know what else a strange child could be interpreted as.
In this context, it's absolutely intellectually dishonest to interpret it in any other way but a bastard. But the Judeo-Christian will probably tell you that these children are born out of wedlock. That they don't have any grounding in the fact that the act of sexual relationship is marriage. That's marriage. They think marriage comes from a priest and a license dispensed by the government.
Oh, I found what Judeo-Christians think. They think that strange children means that they were strangers to God because they were idolaters or something.
But that doesn't compare well with the rest of the scriptures that where Israel is promised to be abundantly profuse in reproducting while in captivity.
And how can God not know you too?
Right. Well, what it says that right here in this chapter. I know Ephraim. And Israel is not hid from me now. In verse 3.
Yeah, I'm reading like the Barnes commentary, and it says the next generation then growing up more estranged from God than themselves. What hope of amendment was there? So they think it's about idolatry. They make everything spiritual.
Yes.
They don't study the scripture. They listen to the pulpit pimp. That's all they do. If they had studied the scripture or listened to someone that does study the scripture, they might be able to see this, but they're not going to do it.
No, they're not. But this strange, this word strange or peculiar here is an adjective. They're not estranged children. They're strange children. There's a big difference. And there are things spoken throughout the later parts of Hosea that would refute that. all the promises of reconciliation and things like that refute that.
What do you think of verse 11, Bill, where it says, willingly walk after the commandment? But it's like Ephraim is oppressed because he willingly walked after the commandment, so it can't be a commandment of God.
That word commandment isn't the regular word for commandment, I don't think. Let me... Oh, this commandment. Yeah, maybe it sometimes is... Commandment of the Lord is usually a pair, but sometimes it's a sava, which is related to this word here. Which verse is this again? I'm sorry, I skipped around windows and lost my place.
11.
11.
Just doesn't seem to make, it seems a bit obscure just because it says Ephraim is oppressed because he willingly walked after the commandment.
Ephraim shall be desolate in a day of rebuke among the tribes of Israel. I have made known that which shall surely be. Then it goes on to speak about Judah. Then Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandment. Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth.
So maybe after the commandment was given, he willingly disobeyed?
Or maybe it's the commandment Jeroboam gave to them.
Yeah, you know what? In the Septuagint, in the Greek, it's not a commandment. It's the plural word for vanities. He walked after vanities, which makes a lot more sense. He trod judgment underfoot. Because he began to go after vanities. That's what the Greek reads. And that's basically how Brenton translated it. But I don't like the first part. Ephraim is oppressed. No, that's Ephraim oppressed his adversary. That's what it says, his opponent. Maybe because the law was opposed to him, as Paul later wrote. The law would be opposed to Ephraim. Israel saw the law as opposed to it because its desires were different than the commandments of the law. So the punishments were opposed to Ephraim, and that's what Paul explains later in, I believe, Colossians chapter 2. Ephraim is oppressed by his opponent. He trampled judgment underfoot. He trampled judgment is what it says. To trample underfoot is katapateo. That's literal. He trampled judgment underfoot because he began to go after vanities, to go behind, literally, vanities. That's the Greek. The NAS, Ephraim is oppressed, crushed in judgment. But the, and this is a big problem that happens all the time, because the Masoretic rabbis added these vowel points, and they're not always the right vowel points. The people that translated the Septuagint saw that whatever verb is rendered as trampled underfoot, katapateo, they translated it as an active Greek verb. And in the King James, it's a passive Greek verb, broken in judgment instead of trampling judgment, right? They're trampled by judgment instead of trampling judgment. And that's how the NAS also. So that must have something to do with the vowel points on that verb. But in the 3rd century BC, they translated it as an active verb, not as a passive verb, which actually makes a huge difference. It makes the difference in whether you're trampling or being trampled, right? So, because he began to go after vanities instead of after a man's command. And at that point, I would want to see the word vanity in Hebrew. Is a lot different than this word. Vanity is the word that gives us, oh, shav. There's another word for vanity. There's hebel, but then there's shav, and that's shin vav aleph. So I don't know what shav. I don't know why it's Brenton wrote shav. He should have wrote shava, in my opinion. And this word commandment is sav, but no, it's a totally different word. It's ayin vav. That TS, no, sati vav. It's not shin vav, it's sati vav. So that's a totally different letter than shin.
In Strong's, though, it says that the word used here for commandment is from shava. It says from 6680. Which is shava, so...
Bible Works 10 has 6673.
Yeah, that's the word for commandment, but in Strong's, it then says that H6673 is from 6680.
He connects
which
them.
Is shava.
I gotta go look up 6673. Ah. Let me see where I found that word for commandment. The word for vanity that's similar, shav, is 7723.
Well, I've just got Strong's up, and it just says from H6680.
Yeah, Sava, that is spelled Ayin Vav He. Where the word for vanity is Shin Vav Aleph. It's a totally different word. And what I was thinking was that perhaps the words are very similar and were somehow confused when they were translated here in verse 11. But the words are for vanity and commandment are quite different. And I can't say with any confidence that this is just a confusion of a letter to cause this difference. Yeah, you know, like that passage in Malachi where it says that the other races will be destroyed. But the King James has some other weird word, and we found it. That's just the confusion of one letter, right? It's just one letter that did that. So I thought maybe there was a similar error here, which would account for why the Septuagint reading says vanities instead of commandment, but that I find that looking at the words, that's not likely. But it must be the Septuagint. They couldn't have taken a word that meant command and mistook it for vanities. They couldn't have. There must be some kind of difference here in the Masoretic text with the Hebrew copy that the translators of the Septuagint had. There must be a difference.
It
Now, the North American Standard Bible tries to add the word man's, M-A-N apostrophe S, to this in order to have it make sense, that he walked after man's commandment. But that I would reject that. I would follow the Septuagint of this verse. I really would. That Ephraim followed after vanities is absolutely apparent.
Yes, and the Septuagint is just as valid as the Masoretic text.
It's 1,300 years older. Even the latest manuscripts of the Septuagint are 500 years older than Masoretic text. Yes, it's just as valid and just as authoritative. There are mistakes in the Septuagint, and how they were made can be explained, but it's just as authoritative. The Masoretic text does not have greater authority than the Septuagint.
If it's vanities, it sort of makes sense if you compare it to verse 5, because verse 5 says, and the pride of Israel does testify to his face.
Right.
So it seems to be following on that note.
So Ephraim trampled judgment. He trampled judgment because he disregarded the laws of Yahweh and stopped enforcing the law. And I would follow the Septuagint there also. Ephraim trampled judgment because he willingly walked after vanities, is how I would understand this verse. Which is after the Septuagint.
Did you say, Bill, that at Malachi 4:1, where it says, "For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven."
And yeah, that's the passage I meant. Right.
Is that so? You're saying that the word for proud there was confused in the Masoretic, and it should, you know, they missed one letter, and that's how they got proud instead of aliens.
Yes.
Oh, really? Okay. Interesting.
I don't remember who found that. I think it might have been some old dude found that. I didn't find that. I mentioned it in my Malachi commentary, but I didn't originally find it. I'm pretty sure he found it, and not me. I might be wrong, but I thought somebody else found that.
I quoted something to you from your Malachi commentary, and then we re-looked at it, and we found in the Septuagint that it was aliens. I remember doing that though, Bill. I found it.
Okay, it might have been you. But yeah. Okay, I kind of remember that now, the Septuagint. But that was what we ended up discovering was that confusion could exist simply by mistaking a D for an R for a D, the Resh and Daleth, right? That would cause that difference to be made.
That's what some old might have found out, because I didn't know about that.
So I would hope to find something like that here, but it's not the case. It's not. It's definitely a corruption of one of the texts, and I would bet the Masoretic text is probably corrupt here. That's my opinion. Because the Septuagint version makes much more sense. I'm just not sure about the first clause, because it's Ephraim oppressed the opponent, is definitely how it reads in Greek. It can't be swapped. You can't, the word for oppress is active, and the word for opponent is the accusative case, which means that it has to be the object of the verb and not the subject. And that's contrary to the way the translators of the Masoretic text translate those first couple of words where it's Ephraim is oppressed, and that makes more sense to me in the entire context of the verse. So I think one translation is flawed in one aspect and the other translation is flawed in the other aspect. That's my opinion. I might give you some insight into the challenges of trying to translate these things and figure them out.
Yeah, well, we're dealing with ancient texts, aren't we? So it's amazing that we have what we have.
I would agree. I mean, I could check the Dead Sea Scrolls real quick to see if this passage is attested. Usually when I look for Jose in the Dead Sea Scrolls, I draw blanks, but we'll see. We actually have most of Isaiah, not so much Hosea.
It's funny how sometimes really important verses seem to be missing.
I know, all the time. It drives me nuts. Let me see what page they got Hosea on here. I went way past it. Nope, the only verse attested to in Hosea chapter 5 is verse 1. And then there's chapter 6, verse 3, and chapter 6, verses 8 to 11. There's a lot of Hosea missing in the Dead Sea Scrolls. 9, 10, and 11, and 12, and 13, and 14 are almost complete, not quite. And there's good parts of 1, 2, 3, and 4. But 5 through 8 are really spotty. So here we are. So the Dead Sea Scrolls aren't going to mitigate this for us. Thanks, Brad. I'm throwing my books on the floor.
Gentlemen, I'd love to set up and chit-chat for duration, but I'm going to have to get a shower and get in bed.
Okay. Good night, James. Take care. Yahweh bless.
Good night.
Yahweh bless. Yahweh bless.
We finished chapter 5. I guess we could stop here. I don't want to rush through Hosea. Do we have a consensus?
Yeah, I'm
not sure.
I'm not trying to run a tyranny. I'm trying to do this by consensus. Okay, I'm going to end the recording here, and thanks for being here, guys. Praise Yahweh.